All right, everybody, I think we could get going on our last session, which we have called widely Achievements, Memories and Legacies. Again, I welcome you here. I'm Mick Cox, I'm the director here of LSC Ideas, which is hosting this particular event, supported by NATO and by the International History Department, and they're not one and the same thing, as I keep pointing out to my friends over in NATO and IHD. What we're going to do here, I have absolutely no idea, but what we brought together was five people who have some reflections. We'll give those reflections in about 5, 6, 7, 8 minutes, no more. We're going to have to be pretty tight. And we're going to begin with David Edgerton over here to my left. Then we're going to move to Lloyd Friedman here to my immediate right. Peter Hennessy over there will go next. David Holloway, who's come all the way from Stanford. David, via Edinburgh and Ireland, historically at least. And then finally, Richard Moore. So with no further ado, David, we look forward to your reminiscences on achievements, memories, and legacies. And please use the microphone.
Oh, right. Thank you. Well, thank you very much indeed. I'm delighted to be here, especially because just in the last year or so, I've become increasingly conscious of the quality of Margaret Gowing's work. And perhaps, sorry, alarmingly, come to a realization that much of my own work has really been modelled on hers, I mean, quite unconsciously. Now, I first met Margaret Gowing as a chemistry student at the University of Oxford. There was an option for us in the history of philosophy of science. Margaret Gowing taught a first term, and which is history, and Rom Harray taught second term, which was philosophy. The course that Margaret Gowing taught was essentially an account of British science from the mid-19th century into, I suppose, the Second World War just after it, and social, economic, and political history of British science. Now, thinking back, she must have been, I think, the only person in the whole of the United Kingdom to be teaching such a course. Most history of science didn't get into the 20th century. And if it did, it was usually US science or perhaps Soviet science even then. Or it was essentially the prehistory of science policy. Now, that course was very much a course of its time, in that it was deeply declinist. She was putting forward in quite strong versions the argument that British science, especially engineering, had been inadequately supported by the state. And, of course, lots of examples from the nuclear story were to the fore. So that course was very, very influential in my, especially my subsequent thinking. Now, I met Margaret Gowing and indeed Lorna Arnold a few occasions after that. I don't think I'm dreaming when I say that the last time I met Margaret Gowing was with Lorna Arnold in Wright's Coffee Bar here at the LSE. And I remember thinking how odd it must be for everyone else here in Wright's Bar to see this two distinguished ladies and not know that they know the most intimate secrets of the British state. But of course they were reminiscing about, I think they claimed that they had both met at the LSE or both connected to the LSE. Certainly Margaret Gowing obviously was, but I don't know about Lorna Arnold. I wasn't her graduate student or anything like that, but she would occasionally give me some very sound advice. I remember her warning me against a particular charlatan, as she described him, that shall remain nameless. And I was also very... I was very influenced by a response she gave to a question of mine. She came up to Manchester to give a paper. This would have been in the mid-1980s. I asked her whether any British scientists who'd been asked to participate in the British nuclear program had ever refused to work on it. And she thought for a second or two and said, no, absolutely not. And that led me into reflecting on the fact that a lot of history of science commentary insisted that the great majority of physicists sort of implicitly or explicitly refused to serve atomic programs and gone off to become biologists. I went and then investigated that whole story. But what struck me then and strikes me even more forcefully now is this very strong sense that she, unlike most people writing about science at that time, had a deeply realistic view of the place of science in the state and science in the world, that she had no truck with the notion, say, that the relations between science and the military were a product of the Second World War or something like that. She insisted that these relationships were of long standing. And if those kind of points seem uncontroversial today, I think she was rather swimming against the tide in the 1970s and 1980s with those comments, at least in the history of science community, at least in the world of public science. So I ended by saying really that Margaret Garing's work has grown in my estimation a very great deal as I've revisited it. And what particularly strikes me is the precision and lucidity of the prose. And time again, I think I've gone back to her work when reading, a PhD thesis, where I've been completely baffled to find that in a sentence or two, not only is the underlying point this unfortunate doctoral student was trying to make was made absolutely clear, but the wider ramifications were beautifully illuminated as well. And I don't think I can give a greater tribute to her work than that.
Thank you very much, David. And over to you, Laurie.
Thanks very much. It's a first sort of a poignant thing, because my last meeting, recollection, with Margaret was, it must have been in the late 80s, there was a big programme, which David was involved in, the nuclear history programme. Mm. And it was meeting, I think, in France. And Margaret was there with Lorna, and clearly not with it in the way that she had been. And it was very sad, especially as when she was with it, there was still those extraordinary sort of sharpness and lucidity. And that was really, I think, the last time I saw her. But before that, I'd seen her quite often on and off during the 80s. Always incredibly encouraging. Mm. Incredibly encouraging. And also... also sharing these very strong opinions on people about whom she was less encouraging. And it was also sort of vaguely awkward. I never felt quite able to disagree, although I sort of often thought this was a little bit unfair. But strong opinions they certainly were. Let me just talk two ways in which I thought important to me, but I think she was important more generally. First, the incredible disconnect between the amount of material that came out, especially in the second set of two volumes, and actually what governments were saying at the time. I mean, she goes on about official secrecy in those, but, you know, we have to keep in mind that there was not a single parliamentary debate on nuclear weapons between 1965 mm. and 1980. Mm. That if you actually asked about British nuclear weapon policy at the time during the Labour government of the 1970s, you either got we will maintain the effectiveness of the deterrent, or we will not be moving to a new generation of nuclear weapons. And they said nothing but that. When we tried to get a study group at Chatham House going with Ian Smart, another figure who deserves to be remembered in all of this, in the from 77, all the civil servants who had agreed to come along were told to stay away. So, I mean, just keep in mind that disconnect between all of a sudden being able to read in extraordinary detail what had been going on at this crucial period, yet being unable to have a proper conversation on the topic at the time. And certainly, I mean, I did my PhD on US strategic decisions, fully aware that there was no way I could do the same work on the UK. And certainly when I came back and from my PhD, it was certainly my feeling that one day another one wanted to do the same thing on contemporary British decision-making, which, of course, what one could then do and changed, really, the whole thing changed in the early 80s. So that's the first point was it set a standard for what you hoped you could achieve, even on the contemporary stuff. The second was as an official history. I didn't think of it much at the time, but Mick reminded me, because I'd completely forgotten, that I'd written a very long review of the first two volumes, of the later, the 74 volumes, in for the English Historical Review, the only time I've ever written for the English Historical Review. There was a very long review. I had no idea what one was allowed to do with these things. It was a very long book, so I wrote a very long review, and it still is quite a long review. But what's interested me, because the wonders of Google, I then found Mick told me, was it opened with a very long disquisition on the problems of writing official histories, which, given the fact that I had no idea I'd ever write one, is quite interesting. And this is what I seem to be worried about at the time. The privilege created a responsibility, and the question is, could you be a conduit for just getting a lot of stuff out into the public domain, which of course she did, but of course she interpreted it more, which we discussed this morning, more than her American counterparts. Secondly, if you were working just with the secret material, were you likely to treat it too seriously? Because something I mean, what one got a lot when one was trying to find out about stuff in the late 70s, as I was, if only you knew, you wouldn't be saying that sort of thing, which is intensely irritating. Even at the time, I'd become aware that stuff that people found that was leaked, that was disclosed, which had top secret on it, was taken far more seriously often than it deserved. I mean, you could often find out what was going on from a decent article in The Economist than you could from these things. And third, were there things that were still being withheld? And again, we've had some discussion of those issues. In my sort of precocity, I gave Margaret rather high marks on this. I was 29 at the time. So I thought she'd done a really rather a good job. But all I can say, when I eventually did come to write an official history, that was the model. I mean, I hadn't realised until I reread this and was looking again at those, actually, how, not that it follows the same structure or anything else, but that the approach, which is not to get bogged down, I mean, I think to some extent, in a way, a mistake, because there's no references in those, and they weren't in mine, because it was just too difficult with SIS and so on. But just tell the story as best as you can, in as privileged a way as you can, accepting that you've got that, and somehow manage to do it without compromising the things that the people who were your sponsors didn't want you to compromise, but not being dishonest or misleading at the same time, which is, is not the easiest balancing act to perform. So I think, I was really interested to hear this morning, Mark, about the origins and how the role that this played in the first volume played in the origins of the official history. But it is an exemplar. It is just how you should do official histories.
Thank you very much, Laurie. Excellent. And Peter, over to you.
Thank you, Mick. Margaret, for me, was a friend, a mentor, and an inspiration. I treasure her memory. I always have. I met her, as Richard Norton Taylor was saying, when we were both young journalists. I was on The Times. And Margaret's and my interests overlapped on two fronts. Obviously, the history of nuclear weapons policy making in the UK. And the question was going on heat again, because the Callaghan government, as Laurie had said, was bound by the 74 manifesto not to contemplate another generation of nuclear weapons, which is exactly what they were doing in secret. And also public records policy generally, on which Margaret had firm views, which I found very sympathetic.
and beautifully expressed in Margaret's case. She never wasted a word. She had this gimlet-like quality, whichever you were talking about, whatever subject. And her and Lorna's work, as displayed with depth and force in those two volumes, taught me much about, not just about the British bomb, but about Cabinet and Whitehall processes and the scientific and technical civil service, and then also the need, as Laurie's just emphasised so well, the need for top-flight official history, written with a care and an independence of spirit, which Margaret was the incarnation of. And when, in the late 70s, I was really quite keen to find out what the Callaghan government was up to, amidst very tight secrecy compared to today, it was, again, long before Michael Quinlan had written that think piece. And as Laurie said, it was very hard for Parliament to get anything more than the scratchiest of information out about the bomb or anything to do with it. I got a very long way in the story in the late 70s before I started to talk to anybody in the current generation of policymakers, because I put what Margaret had taught me about decision-taking in the late 40s, including the technical stuff as well as the Pall Mall, alongside Ian Smart's very good Chatham House paper on the technical options. And it didn't leave that much to be discovered. And I discovered about the Duff Mason report and one or two other bits, and put it in an edition of the Times, which, because the unions were playing up, and we were all locked out, actually, appeared in West Germany. So the copy that caused Jim Callaghan irritation was sent by the ambassador in Bonn in a diplomatic bag and was read by five German printers, me, my mother, and the Prime Minister. But it led to the most enormous leak inquiry, which, because I'm so old, is now declassified in the National Archives. But anyway, it was all down to Margaret, really, that I could narrow it down, which was the key to reporting Whitehall in those days, when it was an element of Kremlinology, is you had to actually soak up the secondary sources and reduce it to the area that you really needed a bit of help on before you bothered people. And so I needed a little shove over the finishing line. Jim Callan and I became quite good friends in the afterwards, but he was not keen on me when I was a young journalist, though I always rather admired him, I have to say. In a word, Margaret and Lorna's work carried a historical value and a great current salience in the 70s, and they still do, for reasons we've been hearing all day. And on public records policy, I felt, as Margaret did, that we needed a new inquiry, which eventually had emerged in the shape of the Wilson Committee, in which Margaret was such a force, and I'm delighted to see its secretary, Graham Aylett, here today with us. And I think 35 years on, it's time for another one of those. I really do. It's a long time since it was looked at in the round. And also, we've got to look at official histories, the degree to which that great tradition that we've heard so much about today has been allowed to dissipate. Is deeply worrying. The people who are hanging on in there are here in this room, actually, and the Foreign Office is the last exemplar of how you can use historians and historical work in current policy making. It's the service department's actually true in the Ministry of Defence, but it's nearly all shriveled away. And the Cabinet Office, for reasons I can't entirely fathom, has decided that the grand tradition will end. It's probably something to do with modernity and efficiency and the latest management bollocks, which I've never ever understood in any of its many forms since I've been reporting Whitehall. But I don't want to be unkind. It seems to me that to throw away that tradition with such insouciance is deeply, deeply depressing. So anything we can do. I put down a PQ in Hogwarts the other day about Brexit and records, that I was hoping that the many departments involved in Brexit will keep the emails, traffic and everything else that the official historian will need. And the reply I got was, we have a very robust system for preserving public records. I mean, one doesn't expect much in one's declining years, but that was pretty meagre, actually, I have to say. So if anybody can think of a way round that, I don't know. I mean, we ought to have a little think on that if we've got time before we finish. Margaret's friendship I always cherished, even when she was cross with me, and she did cross occasionally. I remember once the Canadians had declassified the Royal Commission on subversion that they'd set up after Igor Gusenko, the GRU cipher clerk, had defected in Ottawa. And I was sent over by the Times and wrote it all up. I went to see Gusenko, which was a strange experience. I remember a Jesuit friend of mine was my sort of eyes and ears in case the KGB were following me. I thought it would be quite good to set the Society of Jesus against Colonel Vladimir Nokobolikov, the station chief in Ottawa, and we saw him off. Anyway, I digress. I came back and I wrote it all up. with great flourish, and the Times produced a lot of space on it. And Margaret rang me up, said, "It's all in my book, you know." I said, "Of course it's in your book, Margaret. Well, why did you bother to go?" And I said, "Margaret, you know, a story is a story. Not many people remember that Royal Commission, and also there were little wrinkles of it, and the Guzenko interview on top of it. But, you know, you should have said it was all in my book." And she could be faintly unforgiving of the needs of journalism, couldn't she, for all her manifest virtues. But hers was the best kind of friendship, actually, because it was warm, ever-present and always candid. And we all need candid friends, and Margaret was the most wonderful one. And I was so fortunate, as indeed so many of us are in this room, to have known her. And I salute her memory.
Thank you very much, Peter.
Terrific. And we move on straight away to David Holloway. David?
For me, it's... For me, it's a great... pleasure to be here, to be able to pay my own tribute to Margaret and to her legacy. I first made contact, or actually she first made contact with me in 1980. I looked back at the correspondence. I'd published a paper on the Soviet decision to build the atomic bomb, and she wrote to ask for a copy and could, you know, would I go and see her in Oxford and so on. And the correspondence continued until the mid-90s. And I think the last time I saw her was in 1994 at a conference in Norwich on the kind of breakdown of the Grand Alliance. And by that point, the Alzheimer's was taking effect. The letters were more and more distressing to read, and it was conveyed to me that actually my letters to her were also distressing, so the correspondence ended. But she was enormously helpful to me. She, as others have said, she was could be very encouraging. I was trying to look at the early Soviet nuclear project, and she found that quite exciting. She put me in touch with Rudy Piles, whose wife, of course, was a Russian and who had known some of the key Russian physicists, and with Michael Perrin to talk about Fuchs. And she was genuinely very supportive. But the help she gave was also... the high standards she set and the criticism she would make on the basis of the high standards she thought I should be applying. And I remember once sending her a draft chapter. I sent several draft chapters, but one in particular I remember, which had to do with the response of Soviet physicists to the discovery of nuclear fission and the papers they had written. And I got, I think, the most detailed and stinging critique of anything I have ever written in my life. And that's saying something, and I think back. But also the most salutary. It made me realize, come on, you better do your homework on this. And it was so I pulled my socks up.
And look where you are today.
Well, I'm here to thank her for it. That's what I'm here to for, yes. So... when I was still teaching at Edinburgh, I would go and see her at Oxford, or when I was in London, often meet with her to talk over issues of nuclear history. I also was aware of her very strong views on issues, and I remember once at a lunch, I think in the Royal Society, she was telling me about a row she had. The previous day, where she'd been in a committee meeting where people had started complaining about the welfare state, and you know, she made quite clear that she thought that she owed a great deal to the welfare state, and that the people who talked about how much damage it had done didn't know what they were talking about. What I also liked and find very powerful about her writing is something Richard mentioned earlier, and that is the attention she paid to science and scientists, and how, in a way, they were her heroes in the books. And that's not always true of people writing about sociology of science or science and technology studies. And I think, you know, the, somebody mentioned earlier that her terrifying efficiency. Well, she learned from Piles and other people about nuclear fission. She may have known an she may have been able to tell an atom from a molecule when she started, but I'm not sure she knew a great deal more than that. And she just studied it. And I think that that's sometimes missing now in nuclear history. Of course, that's part of a more general point, that nuclear history of the kind that she wrote is extremely difficult to do. And when she was writing, there were basically the American official histories, right, were about to come out when she started writing. And for a long time, you basically had the American history and the British history, and the history of other nuclear programs was really very sketchy. And if I think about McGeorge Bundy's book, Danger and Survival, from 1988, he basically doesn't have information or studies to rely on in writing about the Soviet Union or China or India or Pakistan. The situation has changed now. We have lots of studies. I think not up to the standard that Margaret set, but we have lots of studies, or at least beginning to study some of these programs. And often I think the emphasis that she rightly put on the science and the technology is missing. And this sense of that it's okay to have an idea, but you actually have to formulate the idea and then you have to implement it or execute it, as the volume two of the 1974 works is called. That sometimes gets forgotten. It's an interesting thing I learned that Yuli Kariton, who was for many years the head of the first Soviet nuclear weapons lab, the kind of Oppenheimer equivalent, had in the 1970s asked the Soviet government to do an official history of the Soviet project. Now, Kariton had done his PhD in Cambridge. Rutherford was his advisor. So he was very interested in the history of the British as well as of the American nuclear project. So, but the government refused. And I think part of the problem why they refused was they were not willing to write about the intelligence aspects, and it would not make sense to write a history without dealing with that, especially in the Soviet case. I remember there's a comment which I couldn't find when I tried to track it down. She says somewhere that nuclear weapons have inspired the kind of loftiest idealism and the most somber reflections of realpolitik. Mm. And I think she catches both of those elements. And that's a very important part of the history, that both of these elements are there. And the most general point I think I draw in a way from her work is I don't think that's reminding me of the quotation. She said, the history of the British atomic project is a microcosm of the history of Britain in the last 40 years. Mm. The corollary is, I think, that the history of the British atomic project can be understood only in the wider context of British history. And that's actually a rather important lesson for anyone writing about the nuclear projects of other countries, that these are not something that you can just, as it were, extricate from the context. And that makes nuclear history both so difficult and so interesting. And it makes it especially difficult to write it as international history. I mean, Margaret's book is national history, although the Anglo-American aspect is very important. But after all our theorizing in political science is about the interactions among states that have nuclear programs, national histories don't address those questions. So how can you actually combine an international history with international theory?
Great last question. Thank you very much, David. And last but by no means least, Richard Moore.
Well, I'm conscious that I am least in this illustrious company here, not not least because I don't personally have any memories of Margaret Gowing, sadly. Although I met Lorna Arnold quite a few times, I never met Margaret. However, Margaret Gowing's work has inspired me in several ways, actually. One is I remember vividly reading the book as an undergraduate, and I was a bit difficult to impress in those days, I guess. I suppose I was quite a difficult student. But Margaret Gowing's book was one of the few that I read that really had a wow factor for me and opened my eyes to, actually, academic history was really quite interesting, and there was an amazing story in here. Reflecting on what we've heard today, it does underline for me how important it is to understand the context of a person's writing. Mm. And hearing about Margaret's life and reflecting on what was happening in Britain when she wrote really improves your understanding of the book, I think. And I find Margaret's personal story inspiring, just as Lorna Arnold's story was inspiring. And then finally, I was inspired in one of my books to have the same structure dealing with the making of policy and the execution of policy. And I used to talk to Kate Pine at Aldermaston quite a bit about this, because it really was sometimes as though there were two different nuclear programmes going on, one in Whitehall and one at Aldermaston, and just seeing them from each end of that very long and twisted telescope was really quite interesting, and that, you know, that too is one of the things that's inspired me to study nuclear history, not just for the lofty aspects of it or even the somber aspects of it, but for the real practical down on the shop floor nitty gritty of what was going on as well. So, you know, for all those reasons, I've found it a very inspiring book and actually a very inspiring day's discussion as well.
Thank you very much, Richard. That gives us about 20 minutes. We're going to finish about 5 to. We're going to say a few words of thanks. By the way, we have a drinks reception immediately afterwards at 5 o'clock, just down the corridor, to which you are all, of course, cordially invited. So we've got about 20 minutes now for further reflections, reminiscences. And we'll start with Zraila. Yeah, please.
Thank you very much. I have had the privilege of listening to what you have said. I do feel that as the humble secretary of the Public Records Committee, I am very, very grateful to Margaret Gowing. Sir Duncan Wilson and Sir Paul Osmond were her colleagues. There's a piece, I think, from a journal called The Times, by a reporter or other journalist called Hennessy, and it said, "Whitehall brief, how Wilson report may avoid paths to the pigeonhole."
Gosh,
and
that's good.
The other subtitle is "Fight by the quote good and great," close quotes, and that personified Margaret perfectly. She was both good and great. And why do I say that? Because her core focus, as it seemed to me, the secretary doing what I was told, was her focus on the raw material from which history could be made, understood, and interpreted, and her resolute wish that that should be preserved. And that was a responsibility which she carried, and she carried the rest of the committee with her. And she gave great support and encouragement as a team member, and she was in fact the sort of anchor for the Public Records Committee, even to the extent of coming over to the United States to make sure that we understood good practice or defects in practice in the United States. Now, I could feel guilty at some of the things I heard today about some people up in London dragging her away from Oxford. Now, if that is an oblique reference to the Public Records Committee, I don't think I want to feel guilty because her role there in the committee was irreplaceable. I also might feel slightly uneasy about the reference to a civil service young pup, and there's snide comments dismissing some of the things that Margaret raised. I would like to make it clear that that was nothing to do with the Public Records Commission, because they were wholly and entirely backing the Margaret Going and corporate analysis, which they made in a rather weighty command paper.
Oh, Lord.
Which was, I think, designed at Margaret Going's quality level. Mm. I certainly hope so.
Yeah.
And I really am very, very grateful indeed to Margaret Going and for her offspring in their tolerance in allowing her to play the part that she did. And if I may offer a memento.
Oh my gosh, what is this?
Hooray!
Hey!
That is the label, that is the.
Hold it up, I think you need a photograph.
That
Nick,
is
one
the,
for the archives.
Look this way, Graham.
We'll have a silent auction between.
Yeah, we'll start building it. We'll start building it 1,000 euros.
Just grandchildren.
Graham, hold it still, please. Thank you.
There we go.
This was in Parliament Street, just around the corner, opposite the cenotaph. And the PRO rather fancied that they could keep the Public Records Committee under their corporate thumb, but we had other ideas and were independent in our view.
Okay. Thank you very much indeed for that contribution.
Can we get your signature on the back?
No.
I'll let me quill pin at home.
I'm chairing. Peter, do you want to come back on any of the points that were made there? Because your name was taken in vain there.
No, I was just mustered. It was a remarkably effective committee because there were only three of them, and you were an extremely good secretary.
Yeah.
And I think I said broke the habits of a lifetime and said something intemperate when I came to give evidence, and Margaret.
That's when you tripped on the stairs.
I could well have done. No,
thank you for remembering.
I said something intemperate, and Margaret told me to calm down a little bit, which was.
How did she do that?
I think she just told me to.
Calm down.
I wish I could remember what the intemperate remark was. It was something like comparing something to being shackled to a corpse. I can't remember who it was or what it was I was talking about. But there we are. These things only come back when you hold up an artifact like that. And you were up a staircase.
We were.
Yeah, that's right. Just next to the Honours Secretariat.
That's right.
It was sort of in an attic, which somehow felt right.
Sounds very British. Gosh.
Yes.
Anybody? Yeah, please, David. You want to come in on any point you want to come in on? Please do. Feel free.
And anybody else? This morning, the issue of patriotism came up a few times.
Push that towards you.
The issue of patriotism came up a few times, and I dug out a quotation from Hancock and Going, Britain's War Economy, 1949. I don't know if these are her words or not, but I thought they were particularly appropriate, not least because they contradicted the picture of what was going on given by Winston Churchill in his official history of the war coming out at about the same time. Let me just read a bit. Even in the darkest months of 1940 and 1941, the United Kingdom did not fight alone. The resisting European governments found sanctuary in Britain. Small bands of fighting Frenchmen, Poles, Norwegians, Dutch, Belgians and Czechs took up the battle stations with the British forces, while in their subdued homelands, obstinate patriots tuned in to Big Ben and formed with each other those first conspiratorial groupings that later grew into the resistance. Mm. Moreover, in the early winter of 1940, while Wavell's men were winning the first desert victories, the Greek state and people flung back Mussolini's attack. Mm. For the British people, these were great months, fit climax to the Battle of Britain and fit reward for their civilian fortitude. So a distinctly internationalist patriotism.
Yes, absolutely right, absolutely right. Great words. Follow that, not easy. Let's try and follow that. Anybody else who wants to drop it? Yeah, please do.
We've heard sort of stories Thank about her being tortured and you know, having too much. I think the one thing that I always remember that gave her an enormous amount of pleasure was when she was on the committee of the National Portrait Gallery, and she always, whenever I saw her after she'd been to that, she was always in a really good mood and really buoyant. She got a lot of pleasure out of doing that, and as she did, I think when she sat on the committee for the museum, Imperial War Museum. Of course, that's what led to another of her, you know, storms, because she resigned because of the move to
charging, yeah.
For entry. She All right. She took that as a great insult to the, you know, to the working class. She did enjoy both of those roles very much.
She was wonderfully eloquent in against charging, because she described how, with the poor household, the free museums of London were integral to the education, and her family made use of them, as indeed large numbers of families did.
Right.
And it was people who knew the square root of damn all about those circumstances who were behind the idea for charging. And it was Margaret to their most eloquent, wasn't it?
Yeah.
She was very cut up about it, actually.
Yeah.
But she loved having a
beer in her bonnet. I think we might have gathered that. Matt, did you want to come in on any issues that came up from the last panel? Anything at all?
I think she had a very strong view. I mean, everything that's been said about you know, the official history and its role in perhaps, you know, providing lessons for government and a fund of knowledge and so on. But she had a really strong sense of official history as being a public good, yes. As being, having, you know, an informed citizenry is what you require, really, for a democratic polity to be healthy, and, you know, sense of health and vitality about that. And I think she felt that official history played a role in that, in providing that. And I think that comes away from reading some of the background papers to the first volume and the second volume.
Mm. Yeah, please do.
Picking up on Matthew's point, I think several people have said today the official histories on the programme are the absolute model of how to write official histories. I've already said that. It's a guide for anybody doing the Falklands history. The concern now is that, given Charitable Town's indifferent state of electronic archives, in 30, 40 years' time, it will be virtually that kind of history. Because recovering information in a clear and concise manner is extraordinarily difficult. That's the challenge that future stories will face.
I say sometimes there's too much information.
That's not kept.
It's not accessible.
It's gone.
So I think
it's gone.
In 1,000 years' time, historians will look back at this year and say it was an oral culture and never wrote anything down.
Laurie, come in, and then Patrick. Laurie.
Just on that, I mean, 2.1, I have had recent experience of looking through even more contemporary documents. The thing is, in the end, a decision has to be marked. So in the end, there is a paper of some sort. But the process by which you reach that decision just isn't as clear as it once was. And if somebody decides that they'd rather fudge it, then there's nothing much there either. But, you know, in Chilcot, we did look at a hell of a lot of documents. The other thing just to keep in mind when people bemoan the problems of the electronic age, at least with that there is a possibility of recovery. When I was doing the Falklands, a lot of the conversations had gone on telephone, and there was no record whatsoever. Yeah. It was quite striking how few records there were of high-level telephone conversations. The Prime Ministers were kept, but even a lot of those, I mean, there were just real nuggets occasionally, because when you got them, they were extraordinary, because they revealed something of what was going in. And I think it's probably true now that far fewer records of telephone conversations are kept than used to be the case. So I think that was when a lot of the problems set in. I mean, email, in principle, if you had a proper recovery programme, but I think probably Hutton killed off that. If you had a proper recovery program, you could have something there.
And it was through Google that I rediscovered your very, very, very first review, which was over long.
It was just over long, and that was...
But very good.
Well, thank you very
that's
much.
Right. Just in case you... Anyway, Patrick, do you want to come in?
Well, the two questions, right? One is record-keeping, the other is official history, and I'd agree with you until very recently, Laurie, about emails, but the current policy now very much is towards automatic deletion of emails after a certain length of time, which might be as little as 3 months or
no, terrible.
18 months.
Yeah.
A foreign office is moving towards that. And I can't imagine what that will mean for those people, because a lot of us rely on our Outlook folders as our main actual filing system now. It could only really work if there's some way of registering material which is efficient, and that's simply what we don't have. We don't have that in the Foreign Office, and we probably don't have it right across government. And you also don't have it in much private business as well. The only place where I think they keep records properly is banks. And they do that because, of course, money is involved, and money is not involved in the public sector. So that's one big issue which is being addressed. I mean, people in the Cabinet Office are aware of this problem and trying to find ways of dealing with it. The other, though, about official history is, and about record keeping as well, is the political will now. It is lacking. And we've had hints today about the way in which the official history programme has come to an end. Well, it hasn't come to an end officially. They've never admitted that they've closed it down. But in fact, no more histories have been commissioned, and all the existing histories have been farmed out to MOD, Foreign Office, and places like that. They won't admit it, though. People like
they won't. No,
no, people like you have asked questions in the House of Parliament, and they persistently evade that. And where the responsibility for that lies, I'm not quite sure. Partly it's in the bureaucracy. We know the people in the Cabinet Office who do want to close it down, but they themselves are under pressure. If you talk to people in the Cabinet Office, they're under enormous pressure from the politicians to save money and to avoid... The main thing now is embarrassment rather than anything else. You know, the classic reason why you shouldn't censor material is not embarrassment, it's to do with things like security. But it mainly now, as far as I can see, is to do with saying something that will cause an unfortunate headline. That seems to be the main motivation. So, I mean, what we do about it is another question, but I think at least ventilating these questions in this sort of gathering is a way of at least making people aware of them.
Has the Freedom of Information Act helped or hindered?
I think it's hindered in all sorts of different ways. I think it's hindered historically.
Yes.
I mean, what you really had when it really worked properly was the Watergate initiative.
That worked quite.
That a lot of material out in the public domain. FOI is a way of getting certain snippets of information if you're lucky, but you never know what you're not seeing. And the choice is being made by officials who are not hostile, but are ignorant.
Well,
they don't know what their story means.
The other problem with FOI, a chief of defence staff who should remain nameless, but isn't the current one.
So that's the previous one.
Told me that he avoided writing anything down because of FOI.
Okay.
He literally avoided writing it down because he didn't think it would be protected properly, so he ignored it then.
Exactly. So the records disappear.
So with your current Foreign Secretary, he's far more indiscreet in what he says in public than he is in his emails. The problem is the other way around, isn't it?
I haven't been reading his emails. I've got a couple of comments here from John Madeley and then from Sue. John.
I was just wondering whether in this internationalist these things are being done differently elsewhere. Freedom of Information, for example, in Sweden's existence in 1766. I mean, are they, and I remember George Jones saying it would be a disaster, but because people would simply talk on the phone and not make a note. Are there other examples elsewhere? What about in the United States?
Somebody told me that a Swedish person told me that they now have what they call the empty drawer policy.
Yeah.
They put all the copies of what they've done in a drawer, and at the end of the week they destroy them because of FOI.
So there you are. There you go.
They're archiving email in the United States. You know, billions of emails are being
archived. They're being archived.
The government. I mean, the
US is doing. I hope tweets now.
Yes. I mean, really, that was what I was going to say.
Thanks,
Sue. It's all about the political will and influence. I mean, a lot of this digital preasion is actually feasible now with money and will. Things have developed a long way in the last 10 years. We have a bit of a gap between the mid-90s and the early 2000s when people suddenly thought we could just keep everything and, you know, it would all survive forever. A lot of work has been done, including by public records. but actually it's because people won't make the decision that that's what should be done. And we need to kind of, and don't have much historic sense.
The other problem,
the importance of this kind of work for an active democracy.
So, yeah, active will, yeah, please.
The other problem with email is, certainly in the District of Trent, I'm not sure about the FCO, is being a historian, I like to keep lots of emails, but you get told that your email box is full. You can't send anything in, or actually you delete something. So, of course, people who aren't historians just delete. They go back to whatever is the oldest set and just delete them.
Hey.
But isn't this central register keep it?
They don't exist anymore. They're gone. So even if we had a Prime Minister and a Cabinet Secretary, and you normally need one of each, or preferably both, for this to work and for the commissioning, the patronage process to work, the techniques, as it were, the engine rooms of the old official histories are no longer there. So it's a problem on a... It's very interesting. If I remember, Graham, you've got the Wilson Committee there report there, they talk about the growing problem of machine-readable records. I think that was the rather quaint... The shape of the world to come, machine-readable records. And you anticipated this in there, actually. In 1980, that is.
Yes.
Yeah. So it's been a long time in the making.
But, I mean, I think the problem is partly the FOI, the amount of information around, the sense that the official historian was revealing something for the first time that really was not known is much harder to create now because I've been through Chilcot. A lot of what we put in there is sense confirming what the journalists were writing at the time. I mean, there's some juicy bits and revelations, and the accumulation of evidence has its weight. But what might have seemed as an extraordinary set of revelations 30 years ago is sort of, a lot of it's out there in some shape or form already. So the problem is, which I think been indicated, the editorialising that takes place with the routine release of information at the moment, including through FOI, means that you've not quite got the sort of authority that an official history might have had. But nonetheless, there's an awful lot of stuff out there.
David, you want to come in?
Just a little bit on the FOI, I would say, requests in the US, that of course people are often wanting to get documents relating to particular scandals or particular hot issues. And I've certainly found in the writing that I'm doing, maybe this is not a good admission to make, is that I'm trying to put these things into some kind of context, which then changes the meaning, because somehow when they're taken out of context or there's some aspect of something that's been declassified or made available, that's misleading, and then very far-reaching conclusions are drawn from it. I mean, one... example, might be a controversial example, is the 1983 war scare in Moscow issue, where you have such a range of views about what's actually happened, and you have to try to weigh all the different... I mean, on the basis of... where in a sense a certain version has got out and drawn a great deal of attention, and you're trying to put it into context and trying to make sense of it. So I think that's a feature of writing in this area, which I think maybe didn't exist before.
Okay, we'll take one little point.
Is the resource issue largely now? Because mostly, in most places, the people who are having to deal with FOI are the same people who should be working on the records for routine review and release, and don't do much, and they're cut all the time. The staff in those areas is cut all the time, so there just are not enough people to produce the material, even according to statute.
I'm conscious of time because there's another group coming in here in about 7 minutes, so I just want to draw the day to a conclusion. Nick wants to say a few words afterwards. May I firstly draw your attention, because we do live in the age of the 21st century, the assessment questionnaire. If you could fill it in, you don't have to put in your age.
gender, you might want to put in your card. If indeed you feel moved, it would be helpful to us to know how well you think it has gone. Thank you very much. We shall continue the conversations across just down the corridor over a drink and canapés. Let me just say a few things very, very quickly, if I could. This is really by vote of thanks, and I need to do this, obviously. Firstly, I'd like to thank, because none of these things get done without organisation, and behind any great organisation, as we found out today, there's people working very hard under the water, working very hard and paddling. And I'd like to thank what I always like to call Team Ideas. That's the people who work with me. I'm the director of Ideas, but I'm hopeless at the front. That's what I do. They do all the hard work underneath the water and behind me. So thank you particularly to Joseph, who's been sitting over there, Adriana, who's done everything. And I wonder if we could just put our hands together to say thank you. It's been a great job. Thank you. Obviously, I'm bound to thank my co-worker in this, Matt Jones, and the support from the International History Department. It's been a work of collaboration. Normally, international relations scholars, which well, I suppose I call myself, and international historians at the school, generally don't talk to one another, and often quite don't get on with one another. But we've managed to break a 50-year cycle, I think, here, Matt. But I have to say, personally, it's been great working with you, and it's been a fantastic collaboration, and you brought some terrific people here. So I wonder if we could say thanks to Matt again for all the hard work. The LSE, I suppose, thanking NATO is not in the normal for the bid. But I have to, because Jamie Shea, who most people here know, is such a great public servant for NATO and such a great supporter of public education. He helped me many, many years ago when I was at Queen's University Belfast. I took my first group of students in 1989 and 1990 to NATO, and Jamie was there. And here we are, you know, 25, 26 years on. Here's Jamie again, who gave us support for this. So, Jamie, you're not here, but thank you very much, and to NATO as well. Thanks to all you who have come here today, either to listen or to contribute to the project. I'm bound to say this after what I said this morning about the LSE. I thank the LSE for all that it has given us, including Margaret Gowing. I'd also like to thank personally Sue Donnelly, the school archivist, who's doing a fantastic job recovering the history of LSE more generally, who wrote a wonderful blog on Margaret Gowing some time ago. And I think without you, Sue, actually a large part of what we're doing here today would not actually be happening. So thank you again, Sue, for your hard work. There are many more I want to thank. I'll thank Margaret Gowing, but I'd like to thank Nick Gowing and the family for coming here today, with providing us with some great personal insights. And with no further ado, I'd like to hand over finally to Nick for a few last words before we retire for a drink and a few nibbles. Nick, over to you.
Let me thank you as well, Mick, for this started many months ago, and just tracking down a few people has taken a bit of time as well. So everyone who got an invitation, we had to, some of you and some who are not here, we had to sort of track you down to make sure you were available, and obviously a lot of people who were in a certain age couldn't come, but thank you very much indeed. I'm tempted to say that we've ended exactly where I think my mother would want it to be, with that sense of taking it forward. And I can almost hear her voice above us saying, keep going, keep going, don't give up. But I'm very struck by particularly what Roy McLeod wrote about, given the continuing role of nuclear technology, it remains essential that we know the routes by which science, technology, industry and government have brought us to the present we know and to a future we will have to deal with. And I would urge the voices we haven't heard around the outside, you're indeed the future, picking up from the 29-year-old Laurie Friedman. Remembering what that was about, and I can tell you he didn't say it, that my mother gave you a reference for Chatham House, which I reminded you about some time ago, but there's no narcissism here at all. It's really to underscore that there's an opportunity here, and I, as a journalist, less practicing now, I'm a bit like Peter, but not as distinguished, there is a lot of work to do here, and for those of you in the academic world, I can see an enormous potential here, not just dependent on funding, but really because there's a big need based on the kind of things we've just heard from this final panel. And I would urge you to think that the work is not over, even if it's a struggle to get the records, even if it's a struggle to get the archive. I'm doing a big project at the moment. We're talking to people. That is what matters. The trouble is the next generation think everything's going to be on a screen. And if it's not on the screen, then it hasn't happened. That's something we've all got to get over, and certainly the next generation. And it doesn't come just by tweets. Finding out where these people are and having that contact, series of contacts, is absolutely vital to all of this. And I say that as a journalist like Peter. And I would suggest there's a need for not just a third volume, but a fourth and a fifth volume. And the challenge is for the generation to pick it up, not really to be defeated by this kind of rather difficult problem that all the experts here have been talking about, which is difficult to get records. Difficulty doesn't mean you can't, as I think James and my mother proved. And even if she upset people, she irritated people, she angered people, in the end, she did it with respect. And that's where you get a distinction and you get renown for being someone who's turned over not just one leaf, but many leaves, and created the picture which often is lacking. Despite what we've just heard, I think there is still a lot that's missing in the daily news coverage. That's not why I left the news business. But there's a lot of context still missing. Yeah. And that's why we need historians. And I'm delighted and very touched on behalf of James, on behalf of our wives, Judy and Jane, and on behalf of Sarah, Margaret, our daughter, and also Becky, who are here, and the other three grandchildren. Thank you. Because we've learned a lot, and it's come out today through LSE Ideas. And maybe we've kindled an idea for taking it forward, which is keeping this discussion going,
absolutely,
whether in our mother's memory or just because it needs to be done anyway. Nick, thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. Thank you very much.